basis.
Mario, spengo.
Laura, come si mette lo schermo?
Per mettere, Mario.
Per mettere lo schermo.
Mario, io sono a zero.
Allora.
Che si veda con un lucido.
Sì, ah, sì, sì, prima sì. Lo si fa subito. Opla, modalità schermo intero e vai avanti con questo. Per andare indietro e avanti puoi usare questi due.
Anche questi.
Ah, anche quelli? Sì, sì, sì.
Okay, so it is a real pleasure for me to be here. I met Ricardo when I was at UCLA and he was teaching there. Then he became my boss when I arrived here in Turin. And I have to say that he's the best boss that I have ever had. He's been the only one also. And probably the only that could be in any case. So when they asked me to give a talk here, I was really very, very, very pleased. So I would have come, no matter volcanoes or whatever, I would have come to your celebration. Okay, so I'm going to talk about this work that is almost finished on the quantization of Minkowski and conformal superspaces. This is a work done in collaboration with Dale Cervantes and Rita Fioresi. The outline of the talk is, first I'm going to give the motivation, and I think that this will be, probably this will be the most interesting part. Then I will briefly describe the classical case, just to put the setting on which we will then add the super part, and then we will add also the quantum super part. So then the third part, I will be more specific, we will talk about the Grassmannian and flag super manifolds, and then we will go for the quantum super Grassmannian. For the moment we will leave outside the super, the quantum super flag, but I will tell you what is what we expect, okay? So that's it. Perhaps the last thing, I will not be able to do it. So, okay, the Poincaré group is the group of transformations that leave the Minkowski metric invariant, and the conformal group leaves it invariant, but up to a factor. Indeed, the conformal group acts not on Minkowski space, as you know, but on a compactification of Minkowski space. We should add some points to Minkowski space in the same way that when we have, for example, R2, we need to add a point at infinity to compactify and get a sphere. So the same thing happens in this case, and one of the first things that we will do is to describe properly this space that is the compact space where the conformal group acts. All these relations between Minkowski space, Minkowski space, conformal space, Poincaré group, and conformal group can be translated to the super case, and we have the same relations. It is a step that is non-trivial, but it is still where we have some geometric intuition in this case, and you will see that I will describe a mathematical formulation of this extension to the super case that at the beginning seems a bit strange, but you will see that it is really the same in the same way in which physicists think about odd variables. Okay. So in principle, odd variables, to me, they have always had a mysterious origin because they are not standard fields. And in fact, the way that physicists describe it in their calculations, everything goes well. But to me, they have always been strange. And also, they are there. They have been there for a long time, since the discovery of the electron. In fact, this is previous even to supersymmetry, since the first time that we have a particle behaving with fermionic statistic, we could have started thinking on supergeometry, and probably supersymmetry could have been discovered before. In fact, well, mathematicians came to think on supersymmetry after physicists, but they think in algebraic terms. The essential object here is what is called the function of points, and I'm going to make an example that will be very clear. I'm of course simplifying what is the concept itself, but I want just to be intuitive, keep as intuitive as possible. So in algebraic terms means that we start with an algebraic variety. For example, we take the sphere, the sphere is 2, and we have the polynomial ring on the sphere. It's an algebraic variety, so affine variety. So the polynomial ring, somehow the polynomial ring and the variety are in one-to-one correspondence. This is easy to see, because you see, if I take the algebra that are these polynomials, this means only polynomials in x, y, z modulo this constraint that makes the polynomials to be on the sphere. This is the algebra that is associated to the two sphere. So if I consider a morphism from this algebra to R, then what I get is that this is given in terms of the images of the generators. It is enough that I give it on the images of these generators x, y, and z. So I give 3 points that satisfy that constraint, that satisfy this constraint. Well, I don't see well here. Satisfy this constraint, then it is very clear that this represents a geometric point of the sphere. So if I have the algebra, I immediately recover the geometric object. Then in the other way it's the same. Once I have the sphere, I construct the algebra. So, but one can think on a generalization of this, and instead of having R, that is the ground field, we can think on putting here homomorphisms from this algebra to any other algebra. Instead of R here, I take homomorphisms to an arbitrary ring, and then what we will get, if the ring is R, we will get the R points of the sphere. It seems that this is just a game here for this simple algebraic variety, but whenever you want to consider algebras or rings that have nilpotent elements, then the subtleties of the nilpotent elements are captured by the functor of points, and you cannot capture them by only the field, but only taking the homomorphisms to the field, to the ground field. So, well, our superalgebras also have nilpotent elements, but they are not algebras. They are algebras, but they are non-commutative algebras. They have some special elements that anti-commute instead of commuting. They are not the most general non-commutative algebras, but they have this thing. They have these odd elements that anti-commute, and in a way we still can keep this geometric interpretation of the functor of points. And in fact, this statement, I'm not sure if it is true, but as far as I can, as I know, this is the largest extension that we can have of standard algebraic geometry, where things still the function of points exists. Perhaps there are others, but as far as I know, we can extend the function of points to a non-commutative algebra if it is a commutative superalgebra. So you see. Here I take the easiest, the simplest superalgebra. It's just the polynomials on P even variables and q odd variables. These variables are the generators. We have to think on them as the generators of the superalgebra. Then, if I take a morphism of this algebra to the ground field, in this case I have put C, you see that there is no complex number that squared is equal to zero, except for the zero. So all the odd variables have to have an image under this homomorphism that is equal to zero. So if I take homomorphisms to the ground field, I lose completely the odd variables. Okay, they vanish. Still, I can, instead of taking homomorphisms to the ground field, I can do as before and take homomorphisms to a superalgebra. Not an algebra, but a superalgebra. If I take homomorphism of this algebra to any other superalgebra, I will have I call it A, of a, to a superalgebra 8, I will have the A points of the superalgebra. And this, then I will be able to send the odd variables to something that is non-zero. So with this intuition here, we see that we still have a classical point of view to treat fermionic variables. Okay. So in the definition of the supervariety, I have the functor of points. It's not something that is complicated. It's something that is easy. You just consider, as I said, the extension of the usual functor of points to superalgebras. And I think this, even if it looks like a bit far from our experience, concept that is far from our experience, I think it captures the essence of the odd variables, and that's why I think it is important, because it allows us to think still in geometrical terms for supermanifolds. Okay. Instead, when one wants to deform or one wants to go to a non-commutative algebra, but a real non-commutative algebra, I mean or non-commutative superalgebra, something that has non-commutativity itself built in the commutation of the variables, of the generators of the variables, there is not this possibility anymore of having the functor of points. This is why non-commutative geometry is something that is very much harder than commutative algebraic geometry. So what is nice and what is interesting about supergeometry, it is an extension of classical algebraic geometry that doesn't change too much. I mean, the theorems for non-commutative geometry are much more difficult, and many things do not extend, and in particular the functor of points does not extend, and we lose the geometric interpretation. We are left, when we have a non-commutative algebra, we are left only with the algebra. We don't have a space to look at it, to get any intuition of. Okay, so I start now describing a moment the setting for the problem. As I told you, I'm interested in quantizing somehow superspace. I'm interested on this for many reasons, but in particular, one reason is that for some time it has been thought it has been difficult. Let's say it like that. To make a compatible supersymmetry with a non-commutative geometry. Okay, so it has been difficult to make this connection. In fact, there were when one tries the easiest or the naive things, it just doesn't work. Supersymmetry is broken. So what we do is we start with some scheme. That is theoretically very very strong. Then we can apply the deformation there, and we will see that the relations between Minkowski, Poincaré, conformal and conformal superspace are preserved through the quantization. So then, because of the construction, because of the it has built itself the action of the group on the non-commutative space, we will not have that problem. I mean, everything will be compatible. Okay, so I just remind we have the Poincaré and the conformal groups are state are explained there. In fact, I will consider the spin group of the of SO2,4 that is the conformal group because there are going to be fermions in the theory and well also it's it is necessary for this approach and well we have. We will consider the group as you know it has an algebra that is the algebra of polynomials in the entries. Let's say that SL4 is also an algebraic variety, an algebraic group. So it has an algebra associated that is are polynomials in the entries of the matrix. Modulus, the relation that I have written there, that is the determinant of that matrix that is also a polynomial, should be equal to 1. So this is the algebra for SL4. And it is not only an algebra, it is also a coalgebra. In fact, it is a bialgebra, it is a Hopf algebra. I don't want to enter into details, but what is important that one should remember is that besides the multiplication, there is something called the co-multiplication that takes one element of the algebra. I can see. Takes one element of the algebra and gives something that is in the tensor product of the algebra with itself. You see the multiplication will take two elements of the algebra, so we'll take an element in the tensor product of the algebra with itself and we'll give it one element. The co-multiplication goes the other way around. And, well, you see why we have this co-multiplication. This co-multiplication, if you look at it, it is just the multiplication of matrices. Essentially, it is the multiplication of matrices. And the multiplication of matrices is the group law. Okay, so encoded in the co-multiplication, it is the group structure that we had for that algebraic variety that was SL4. Okay, so we have SL4, and then we have to decide how SL4 is our conformal group. So, how it acts? What is the space on which it acts? The homogeneous space on which it acts, that is going to be the conformal space. So, well, we take the canonical basis of C4, and we think in. The Grassmannian of two planes inside the space, the four-dimensional space. This is okay, G24. So look that any a plane will be represented by two four vectors that are not dependent, that are linearly independent. For example, I can take this two plane, the plane that is the span of the vectors e1, e2, for example, and this is one of the points. This plane is one of the points of our space, and if one looks, there is a natural action of SL4, obviously, because SL4 acts on the two vectors, and but. One can compute and see that this plane P0 is left invariant by this upper parabolic subgroup. So, in fact, this Grassmannian of two planes in four dimensions is this quotient here, SL4, over this parabolic. Okay. Well, there is a way of describing. We are interested now in G24 as an algebraic variety. So what is the algebra that we will associate to it. It will have encoded not only the this is a projective variety, so the functor of points is it has some sublattice, but I will not comment here. The point is that we want to associate an algebra to G24, and it we will have in fact an algebra that is associated not only to G24 intrinsically, but associated to a certain embedding of G24 in a higher dimensional space. And this is what is called the Plucker embedding. And one starts considering the set of two forms over C4. This is a six-dimensional space. And the Plucker embedding is, well, to any plane that is spanned by two vectors A and B. I take the two form given by A, antisymmetric tensor product with B. As you see, well, it is clear that it has six independent components, and that a change of basis will not change the plane. If I change the basis by combining these two vectors A and B, if I change the basis, that will have no effect on the plane. It will be the same plane. So there is a GL2 that leaves acts on the right and that leaves the plane invariant. Okay, when this GL2 acts on this product, what we get is just a number in front of it. Okay, so this is indicating that in fact I should take this space that I was considering C6, but modulo a relation that identifies vectors that are proportional to each other. That is exactly is the projective space, the CP5, the projective space in five dimensions. Well, one can prove that this map is an embedding, and also one can prove that the image of this mapping, that is what interests us, is the set of two forms that satisfy this condition. This condition is equivalent for P to be decomposable in terms of two vectors A wedge B. And in coordinates, this is the relation that one obtains. It's the Plucker relation. It is a quadric. And since it is equal to zero, you see it's a quadric that is well defined in the projective space. So in the projective, it is well defined, and we will consider it on the projective. The algebra that we associate to the Grassmannian is this algebra that I have here. I have the polynomials in all the variables yij with I less than j modulo the Plucker relation. I know that the mathematicians would like to have more explanation about this, but I'm going to leave it like that. You see that here, well, at least we have something that identifies G24 and also something that identifies the embedding. I mean, we are explicitly using the embedding. Okay. In particular, one way of seeing this space, this G24, we will need this because then afterwards we will see this algebra that is inside the algebra of the group. So, if you take for example the two first columns of a group element, these for sure are independent because the group has. The four columns are independent in the group element, and we can think on that as the vectors being a basis of the two plane, and in that case the minors associated to these two vectors correspond to the variables ij. Okay, that's what I was saying, that in fact one can prove that the algebra of G24 is inside the algebra of SL4, because the algebra of SL4 has all these as generators, and the algebra of G24 has only the generators that are these determinants that are in terms only of A and B. Okay. Okay, action of the conformal group. Well, SL4, as I have said, acts naturally on this homogeneous space because of the construction. We will see the actions. The action can be seen also as a coaction. If we work in terms of the algebra. So working spaces and algebras are kind of dual. So if I take about, if I talk about the action of a group on a space, if I consider the algebra, I have to talk about a coaction. It is something that is inherited also from the coproduct, because here, well, one has to compute it, because y, k, l are those determinants that I showed before, but there is a coaction that to any element, or at least to a generator in G2-4, makes it correspond an element that is in the tensor product of the group algebra times the algebra of the homogeneous space. So it's another way of seeing the action of the group that will be useful when we go to the quantum case. Okay, so I guess everybody understands that there is an atlas for this projective variety that is given, well, for example, for you see, if these two vectors have to be independent, at least one of the minors should be different from zero. So you can have all the possibilities, first row with second row, first row with third row, etc. And this, the points that have one of these minors different from zero are an open set, and they all cover the manifold. They are all the same, so we in particular, we can take U1-2 as an example, and this is what we call the big cell of the Grassmannian. It's a dense open set also inside the Grassmannian, so it contains almost all the points, except some points that have to be added to complete it to the Grassmannian. Okay, so one-two means that this column, this minor, should be different from zero. So we can always make a change of basis in which the plane is expressed in this way. I have the identity here, and I have an arbitrary matrix here. This is a parametrization of the big cell. You see, the big cell is then just C4. I mean, it's just the four-dimensional space. If we want to compute, of course, this is a subset of the Grassmannian. We would want to compute the set of transformations in SL4 that leaves the big cell invariant. It means that takes points in the big cell and gives us points that are also in the big cell that do not go out, do not go to these points at infinity. Then we find that this group is the lower parabolic that we have here. And in fact, once we explicitly, well, here you see L and R have to have determinant different from zero, so I redefine this entry here as NL for convenience. And then when we explicitly write the action, you see what we have here, it is just the Lorentz group. It's SL2 times SL2, and here we have the translations. So what we have is that shown is that the big cell is just the Minkowski space. Okay. If one can generalize this picture to the supercase, look that now the superconformal group is SL4-1, and then through the functor of points I can express an element of SL4-1 in here, where the A's are even elements in the algebra that I have chosen. And the things with Greek letters are odd elements in the algebra that I have chosen. So this is the entries are in some algebra A. This will be an element of the functor of points of the group SL4-1 applied on this algebra. Of course, I have to have the condition that the Berezinian is equal to one. Then, this, as before for SL4, I have here the super algebra that represents the supergroup. It's just the polynomials now understood for even and odd variables modulo the condition on the Bayesian. Okay, so the superconformal space will be the Grassmannian of two zero planes in the four slash one space. Okay, so what does it mean? It means that I take the space 4/1, and then I take two even vectors, and this span a two-dimensional space. And well, this is one. This would be one element of the super Grassmannian. And the procedure is exactly as before. We can describe also a Plucker embedding for it. Look that now, for the Plucker embedding, I have to be careful because now these two forms, you have to take into account that when multiplying two odd forms, you get a symmetric quantity. So I cannot say that it's anti-symmetric, you get a symmetric quantity. But in summary, what we have is that given the canonical basis with the first four elements that are even and the last element is odd, this is a canonical basis for lambda c 4-1. And then we can see that we have the first these first elements are even, then these others are odd. And then we have the last element that is also even. So that's why we have C7/4 as our embedding space. Okay. So for the Grassmannian, the definition, in fact, should be that we consider modules of rank 4. We consider, in fact, submodules of rank 2/0 inside modules of rank 4/1. This would be the correct definition. With work with free modules, it can be done. I mean, there is some technical detail, but free modules are better because they have a basis, so they are essentially they are vector spaces. And look at the Plucker map. The Plucker embedding is exactly the same as we had before. It looks exactly the same. By doing the calculation of the image of this map, we see that the points that are in the image of this map should satisfy not only the standard Plucker relation that we have here, but some other relations that complete that one. It is not necessary that you read all of them, but you see that there are these that are related to the odd variables, and then this last one that is related to this last component, the epsilon wedge epsilon. Okay, so we add some relations that involve the odd variables. We call them super Plucker, and we can also to this Grassmannian we can associate this algebra that is, the super Plucker ideal is the ideal generated by these relations, and it is pretty much the same. I have to say that usually super Grassmannians and super flux usually are not projective varieties, but we are lucky in this case that G24 and the flag that we will need later on, they are projective super varieties. So we have that. This means that we, in fact, have this embedding into a projective superspace. Okay. So as before, for the Grassmannian, the super Grassmannian can also be presented in this way as a subalgebra of the group algebra of the group superalgebra. Generated by these determinants that are essentially, the determinants of the first two column vectors of an element of the group. And in the same way, we have the action of the supergroup on the super Grassmannian that can be also expressed as a coaction. I think I haven't written the explicitly the action there, but there is no need. The big cell is the same. I mean, for the big cell, I take also I need also to have if these are the two vectors if I have two vectors that span the two plane, look that the last components should be odd because the last vector is odd. So to have two even vectors, I have to multiply the component in the last basis vector by an odd component, by an odd variable in the respective algebra. And I can only, if I'm taking U12, where this determinant is different from zero, I can only bring to this form. And look at what I have here C4, and then I have two even variables, and this is the algebra associated to the big cell of the super Grassmannian. What happens with the group that leaves it invariant? Well, I have something like this. If I compute the group that leaves invariant the big cell, I have something like this. Although I have cheated here, in fact, what I get is something that in this place has an arbitrary odd vector. Okay, so I will get zero only. The only condition that I get is zero here and here, but not here. Okay, but I have put it equal to zero because if I put it equal to zero, I recover the super Poincaré group. So in fact, the big cell is left invariant, but by not only by the super Poincaré, but also by some extra odd kind of translations. Okay. So you see, here you can see the action. I mean, here it is clear that is I have the super Poincaré group. I have it here acting. You see, I have only the vector theta, so that is a two-component vector. It is in fact a Weyl spinor that transforms with L minus one to the right, so to the contragradient representation. And you will tell me, well, but there is, for having the superspace, I need also a spinor of the opposite chirality, so I will need something like this also. And then that's what where the flag enters, to add this other spinor that is missing here. I have to consider not the Grassmannian, but I have to consider the flag of two zero planes into two zero subspace into the 2-1 subspaces of the 4-1 space. And I'm not going to enter into this because I will restrict to this superspace that is what we call in physics the chiral superspace. But I just mentioned that in order to have the complete Super-Minkowski space, we need to consider, instead of the Grassmannian, we need to consider the flag. Also, well, because you know that since the Weyl spinors are not real representations, are complex, genuinely complex representations, we cannot impose a reality condition. So we are all the time working on the complex. And this sentence I put here for mathematicians that were attending also a seminar some other way. So what do we do with the quantum? Well, look that we have now something very, very easy to quantize because we have a group, the conformal group. We can get a quantum group. Then we can have the homogeneous space and the action of the group. We can pass this to the quantum setting also in terms now of the coaction of the quantum group on the quantum homogeneous space. And we have a big cell that will be the Minkowski space. We can have also a quantum big cell. And this quantum big cell will be the super Minkowski space. Well, it will be the chiral super Minkowski space. OK, the passing from the group to the quantum supergroup means this. And this is a lot of things. But if you look other than all these minus ones that take into account the parity, what you see is that there are some q's that are the deformation parameter that are, if I put q equal to 1, then I recover just the standard commutation rules, the commutative algebra of the group. With the minus ones, I get the super algebra. Taking into account the minus one, I get the super algebra of the supergroup. So this is a deformation of the group. But what is interesting here, and this for all the people that do quantum groups, it is something that is clear, is that with that deformation, with that standard deformation, the coproduct of the supergroup does not get deformed. Okay, the coproduct is not deformed, so somehow the group law does not change. The group law does not change. It means that if I am going to understand the group law as supersymmetry or superconformal transformations, superconformal transformations do not change. The only thing that we are doing is that we are now quantizing, we want to quantize space-time, we want to put it with as a non-commutative manifold, as a non-commutative space. Then the group that acts on it cannot be a standard group. It has to be also a non-commutative manifold. But as for the group law is regarded, it is the same. So that was the incompatibility, I think, that we found between the quantization and keeping the supersymmetric transformations, that we were trying hard to make a group, a standard group, acting on a non-commutative manifold. And that was the origin of all the problems. Many people, what did is just to change the supersymmetric transformation, deforming is the supersymmetric transformation, to try to keep things. But I think what it has to be done is to change the character of the group into a quantum group, so into a non-commutative manifold. And we are lucky that then supersymmetric transformations will not change. Okay, so then what do we do for the quantum supergrassmannian? We don't have now the geometric interpretation of two planes, etc. So what we do is the definition that we had before. We take these determinants, and then we take the algebra inside GL4, inside the algebra associated to GLQ4, that is the algebra that I presented to you before, but take the subalgebra generated by these determinants. Okay, so the subalgebra of this, that is generated by these determinants. Of course, one has to check that this subalgebra is obvious, because I said the subalgebra generated by this. But are these independent? This is the question. This is the question. And then when one goes to sort out this question, it happens that, well, one has to do some hard calculations to compute the commutation relations among the determinants. But when one gets additionally, gets additionally are the other than the commutation relations that are well modified and etc., one gets the Plucker relations also, with now some Qs or Q minus one in the middle. So then we have completed our task in the sense that we have the homogeneous space described as a subalgebra, and we can have also the in this way we can have also the coaction. I haven't written it here because it's only formulas, but what it follows from the construction. I mean, I have now a coaction of the algebra of the quantum supergroup into this quantum super quantum superspace. I can still go to the big cell. I don't have time, but I can still go to the big cell, and then I will get the quantum super Minkowski, and what it will be, I will get also the quantum super Poincaré. And what it will be nice is that in this way I will have found a quantization of space-time that is consistent with the actions of the group, is consistent with supersymmetry, and also can be extended to the conformal symmetry. There was something that I still wanted to say. Well, there had been a lot of I remember we were trying long time ago. We were trying to define chiral superfields, but quantum chiral superfields. So chiral superfields are non-commutative spaces, and we had a lot of troubles whenever we wanted to quantize the odd directions of the manifold. But in this way, the ring that I have just presented of the quantum Grassmannian, that ring that I have just, or super ring that I have just presented, is just the algebra of the quantum chiral fields. From there, one can go to the big cell and compute a star product. And what I can tell you, I'm not going to put any formula, but what I can tell you that the Poisson bracket already of the star product, that is the Poisson bracket is the first order in the expansion of Q. The Poisson bracket is quadratic. It is quadratic in the variables. It's not constant. Okay, so it's not just like a Moyle-Weil type deformation. The Poisson bracket is quadratic in the variables. So we are just finishing. We are checking also the calculation for the superflux because they are a bit harder. But once we have it, we will have. Say completed this scheme, and then for the physical implications, well, I'm looking forward to see what happens when I plug this into some physical theory, starting with a Besumino model, for example, or more ambitiously, since I have also the conformal symmetry or superconformal symmetry implemented, well, why not doing an equal for Super Jan Mills, for example. So that's all. Thank you very much. And congratulations, Ricardo.
Or comments?
I would like to understand better which is the kind of deformation in the sense of the non-commutative geometry that you put in the sense that you said at the very end these are not of the kind Moyle-Weil. So is it a deformation of a quasi-triangular related to a quasi-triangular of algebra? That
no, I don't know, but I think it may be because this quantum group are quasi-triangular, if I remember well, isn't it? The standard yeah. Quantum group associated to semi-simple, aren't they quasi-triangular?
They are. So at least the bosonic sector you analyze, if you analyze just the bosonic sector, these are the Fadeva-Eshetek intactagen quantum groups?
Yeah.
Okay.
This was done, also the even part of this construction of the Grassmannian and everything, was done by Rita many years ago. The classic part was done by Rita Fioresi, but like more than 10 years ago, I don't know, a long time ago.
So on one end, this is a different construction from just considering a quantum group or a quantum supergroup in its homogeneous space, because you want to embed it in a flag manifold, you want to consider the conformal.
I don't think, well, if you take the formations of super Minkowski or Minkowski space, there are as many as you want. I mean, there are.
They've been classified.
And the formations of the Poincaré, quantum Poincaré groups also, I mean, but quantizing a semi simple group is something more delicate. I mean, you cannot put anything in there. And there is this standard quantization. And it is nice that you can pass it to the homogeneous space, and you can pass it to to the big cell, and then you have the big cell, and all this can be done in the super and in the quantum. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. So I think that we should pass to the following speaker. Guido Dall'Agata, who will talk about supergravity dual of CFT Universal Sector.
Speriamo, il microfono magari.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about the supergravity dual of n equals 1. Doesn't work, okay. Superconformal theory's universal sector, which is work I've been doing recently. We published, we timely published a paper with two postdocs in Padova, and I say timely because 1 week later there were three papers by three different groups trying to do exactly the same thing we did. Of course, when I was invited here to talk at Ricardo's Fest, I was, first of all, of course, very happy of the invitation. But I was a bit hesitant, I don't know how to say, to choose the topic on what I was going to talk about, whether to talk about black holes or other things that could be more related to Ricardo's work. But then I realized that in the end, in this latest work that I have, there is a lot of what I've learned from Ricardo and of the things that I've learned from him. And as you will see, there are many characters in the story that I'm going to tell you which are related in the end to Ricardo. Of course, the gauge gravity correspondence is not being invented by Ricardo, but by Maldacena in 97. I came here to the Politecnico, I came here to Torino for my PhD in 98, so just after the gauge gravity correspondence, and in the fall of that year, I started working here at the Politecnico with Anna and Ricardo, and I owe a lot to them. The characters in this plot, in this story I'm going to tell you are, beside the gauge gravity correspondence, the Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, which is a new fancy name for something which is well known and on which we worked actually during my PhD here with Anna, Ricardo, and Sergio, which is a T11 manifold. Actually, the T11 manifold is one special instance of Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, but there are others which I will describe shortly soon. Then during my PhD here, I learned really gauge supergravity, and this is also present in the work that I'm going to present today, and especially five-dimensional supergravity, which was also done during my PhD here. And another character which I'm sure Ricardo likes are tensor multiplets, and this is something else which we worked later on while I was a postdoc in Berlin. So all these characters are part of the story that I'm going to tell you today, which is the fact that that we have description of what I call the universal sector of superconformal field theories through the EDS-CFT correspondence. Any four-dimensional superconformal field theories with at least n equals 1 supersymmetry has a finite universal spectrum which is essentially the spectrum of pure gauge operators. We will see all conformal field theories which can be realized through the EDS-CFT correspondence, of course, may have different matter content, but for sure they will have some gauge sector. And this gauge sector and the structure of the gauge operators is somehow universal. And what we did in our paper was to construct the five-dimensional supergravity, which is dual to this sector, and hence it captures the dynamics induced by adding these operators to the Lagrangian, these deformations, or by turning on valves of these operators. And the interesting thing is that this model is a consistent truncation of type 2B supergravity compactified on a so-called squashed Sasaki-Einstein 5 manifold, and we'll explain later on better what I mean by that. And hence it is a gauged five-dimensional supergravity with many interesting properties that I will try to describe in a while. So, of course, everything I'm going to talk about is in the context of EDS-CFT correspondence and in the context of trying to extend EDS-CFT correspondence to more realistic scenarios in which you try to lower supersymmetry. The original idea is, of course, to take a compactification to four dimensions starting from string theory. And in order to preserve some supersymmetry, you would do that by taking a Minkowski four-dimensional manifold times some Calabi-Yau. But then in order to obtain some interesting physics, you start putting a stack of brains which fill, for instance, in type 2B. You take these three brains. These three brains will fill the four-dimensional Minkowski space. And of course, they will be at a point on the Calabi-Yau manifold. Of course, if you take a large number of these brains, there will be some back reaction. And at the end, in the back reaction, the Calabi-Yau will be deformed, and somehow a new radial coordinate will open up, some sort of fifth dimension, which, if you have a large number of brains, in the end will be a real fifth dimension, essentially infinitely extended, because at some point, if you're interested in the physics close to the brains, at some point you can more or less forget most of the physics related to the compactness of the Calabi-Yau. Of course, if you do that on a standard Calabi-Yau manifold, close to the brains, you just see flat space. And hence, if you see flat space, essentially you will have a spherical horizon around the brains. And the near horizon geometry in that case is just the famous ADS5 cross S5 geometry, which is dual to the field theory living on this stack of brains, which see essentially a flat space, and in the end, then it will be an N equals 4 supergiant theory. If you want to make things more realistic, of course, you try to choose a different type of Calabi-Yau. You choose a Calabi-Yau in which you will not have a spherical horizon anymore. You try to put these brains at points of the Calabi-Yau where maybe you have singularities. And then if you have singularities, what happens is that the physics will change. The physics will change because the D3 brains will not see anymore a spherical horizon, but they will be, if you put them, of course, at the tip of the cone, they will see essentially, their horizon will be essentially given by the base space of the cone, which will be a five-dimensional manifold, which, of course, will have to satisfy certain requirements if you want to preserve supersymmetry and to solve equations of motion. And the near horizon geometry in that case will not be anymore ADS5 cross S5, but it will be ADS5 cross Y5, where Y5 is a certain manifold. And what type of manifolds can you use? Of course, this depends on the consistency requirements. So you try to solve the equations of motion, and you know that if you put some D3 brains, you will have they will couple to five-form fluxes, and the five-form fluxes will be proportional, essentially, to the volume of this five-dimensional space. And, of course, the five-form is self-dual, so you'll also have a five-form flux on the five-dimensional ADS space. And if you look for the conditions to have a consistent base space, and you require some supersymmetry, and of course you want to solve equations of motion, you will end up having two kinds of conditions. The first one is that this manifold must be Sasakian, and there are different ways to express the fact that they are Sasakian, but one of the conditions is essentially that there is some well-defined, globally defined spinor on this manifold, which will satisfy a certain Keeling equation, which depends on the flux, and that they are Einstein in order to solve the equations of motion. Of course, the fluxes will back react, so the geometry will not be flat anymore. So these are the so-called Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. And the Sasaki-Einstein manifolds can be described indeed in terms of spinors, but can be described also in terms of other geometrical quantities, which are a one form and a set of three, two forms, which here I collected into a J, which is, we will see, the Kähler form of the base space. I mean, this space is five-dimensional, but you can construct it as a vibration. And omega, which is essentially the holomorphic form on this four-dimensional base. And there is a U1R symmetry. So these spaces are essentially always constructed as a vibration of a circle over a Kähler four-dimensional space. So you can describe and use these forms essentially to describe this kind of manifold, these Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. As I said before, there is at least one Sasaki-Einstein manifold which is very well known, which is the T11 manifold, which is really a group coset space. It's the quotient of two SU2 groups divided by IU1. But there are others. All the spaces which have been constructed so far are essentially topologically the same thing, S2 cross S3, but they are different metrics. And depending on the metric that you put on the 2-sphere and the 3-sphere, you'll get different manifolds. As I said, one is the T11 space, which has SU2 cross SU2 isometry. In addition to this U1, which is always there, you will always have a U1R because you have this circle vibration, which is also necessary in order to have a dual n equals 1 theory. You will need to have some conformal n equals 1 theory. You will need to have a U1R at least. But then you have different isometries, and these different isometries, depending on the space, now we have infinite classes of new spaces called YPQ and LPQR, labeled by these P and Q numbers, PQ and R numbers, which have, however, less isometries, and these extra isometries correspond to flavor symmetries in the dual field theory. So, for instance, in the case of the T11, the gauge theory, which is dual to that, is given by two gauge groups, two SUN groups, and you have a couple of chiral fields which are in the bifundamental. They are in the fundamental of the first gauge group and antifundamental of the second, and vice versa for the B field, and they are doublets of these SU2s. Now, when you start describing the dual gauge theories to the YPQ and LPQR, things become more complicated. And of course, they will depend on the numbers, P and Q. So here, I just show you the simplest one, which is the Y21, and you see already that things become more intricate. You start having four different gauge groups, you start having a lot of different matter fields which are in different representations of the flavor group, and things, of course, will become more and more complicated by changing these numbers, P and Q, and PQR in the case of LPQR. So we have, anyway, a duality, which is well established in the context of the ADS-CFP correspondence, between a field theory, a conformal field theory, or a number of different conformal field theories with different matter content. You'll have different numbers of gauge groups, as you see here. You'll have different numbers of flavor fields, and so on. And we have, however, a dual supergravity description for all these theories. Then what kind of physics can you do with this? Of course, you can do many different things. You can start studying the supergravity backgrounds, do the computations of the masses of the Kaluza-Klein fields living on this space, and this will be useful for predicting the anomalous dimensions, a strong coupling in the conformal field theory. You can try to study the formations of the field theory by looking at the renormalization group flows, which are mapped into domain walls in the context of the supergravity solutions in the context of supergravity, and then you can start discussing perturbative and non-perturbative effects on four-dimensional effective theories and how this can be related to this matter content. Now, more recently, of course, there are applications to holographic superconductors, condensed matter applications. I mean, ADS-CFT has had huge development in the last few years, and of course, you can imagine to have many different things. Of course, there is a problem if you want to try to describe these field theories by looking at the supergravity. What is the problem? The problem is that, for instance, if you take your field theory and you try to deform it by turning on some operator, then generically, the introduction of a new operator will drive new operators in the game. If you take the OPEs, of course, of this operator, generically they will close on some other operator, and then, hence, in the end, you will have a number of these operators which will enter into the game, and this means that whatever deformations you're trying to discuss, for instance, you will really need to study the full 10-dimensional equations. You will never be able to reduce yourself to a 5-dimensional problem. Even though the supergravity description is a product of a 5-dimensional space and a non-compact, and hence a 5-dimensional theory living there, and a 5-dimensional compact space, even if you do the Kaluza-Klein analysis, you will never be able generically to study simply a 5-dimensional problem. You really have to do the full computation in 10 dimensions, because even if there is one supergravity field in 5 dimensions which corresponds to this operator, the introduction, giving an expectation value to this field, will drive you through the equations of motion all the other operators, an infinite number of them. Of course, if the operator product expansions close, If there is a special structure so that the operator that you want to turn on or the operators that you turn on will close among themselves and the other operators will not essentially talk to these, then you have the chance to keep only a finite number of states. And this is exactly what we are trying to do. And if this is possible, this means that from the supergravity point of view, there must be some consistent truncation of your spectrum. So you do this compactification, you have a full Kaluza-Klein expansion, you have a spectrum with an infinite number of fields, all these towers, but if the structure of the dual field theory is of a special type, then there must be a supergravity description with a finite number of fields, and this means that there must be some consistent truncation. Of course, having a consistent truncation doesn't mean that you have really you're really studying the effective theory on the, in this compactification. There are different types of consistent truncations which are not effective theories. Having a consistent truncation doesn't mean that you can keep necessarily the lightest modes. So here I have some examples which show you different types of possible consistent truncations. If you take M theory on a 7 torus, then you get N equals 8 pure supergravity in 4 dimension. And here, of course, you truncate to the massless modes, and hence, detruncation to the massless modes is also, of course, an effective theory. You are truncating away all the massless modes, so you're really describing the lattice degrees of freedom you have in your theory. The same is true for the N equals 8 SO8 gauge supergravity that you can derive by taking M theory, for instance, on a 7 sphere. You are keeping only the lightest mode. Not all of them will be massless in this case. You have a gauge supergravity. Some of the states are massive. However, the masses of the states that you keep are lower than the typical Kaluza-Klein mass scale, and hence you still have a consistent truncation, which is also an effective theory. Generically, however, when you have coset manifolds, for instance, and you do a coset manifold reduction keeping only the left invariant modes instead, you will have a consistent truncation, but not necessarily you keep the lightest modes. You may have massive states which are in your truncation, which are more massive than other states that you have thrown away. However, somehow you have a consistent truncation. You can still keep a finite number of fields because you are taking essentially singlets with respect to some symmetry, to some isometry. So, what is the consistent truncation that we looked at? And why it's interesting? It's what I call the universal sector of n equals one theories. So n equals 1 conformal field theories have, generically, no matter what's the theory, will have different types of fields, but there will always be some gauge superfields, which are somehow universal. I mean, superconformal field theory, n equals 1 superconformal field theory, which wants to be a gauge theory, will have, of course, the gauge superfield. And then you'll have a number of matter fields, which, however, will depend on the compactification. This should have been a Y5, not a Y6. Will depend on the horizon that I described before, which is seen by the brains. And, of course, you'll have indices, which will depend on the flavor symmetries that you have in your theory. So you have some part which is universal and some part which is instead which will heavily depend on the compactification, on the type of vacuum you're studying, on the type of model you're interested in. Of course, generic operators will be essentially constructed, at least those which are dual to supergravity states, will be single trace operators, will be essentially words constructed by using these letters above. And you see that you can have several different types of these words, of these operators. Operators constructing only using the universal sector, operators constructing using both, and operators constructing using only the matter sector, of course. For instance, the currents of the flavor currents will be fields which will heavily depend on the matter content. So you see that if you only look at one type of operators, those which are constructed by using the gauge superfield, then you have a spectrum of operator which is finite, because this is a fermionic superfield, and hence you cannot have an arbitrary number of them, whereas when you have a matter field, you can take s to the power n, and this is an allowed operator. So you have essentially only these five different possible operators, and each of these operators will correspond to a certain state in your field theory and will correspond to a specific multiplet in the supergravity description. And as you can see, it doesn't contain only the so-called massless multiplets. It doesn't contain only hypermultiplet and the gravity multiplet, but they contain also a massive gravitino multiplet, which sits in the first Kaluza-Klein tower, and keeps also the so-called breathing mode vector multiplet, which sits in the second Kaluza-Klein tower. So you have massive states, which are more massive than other states, which are which sit in the N equals 8, for instance. In the case of this, of the compactification of the Phi sphere, you will have additional states sitting in the N equals 8 gauge supergravity, which are not present in this in this truncation. However, this sector is universal. So if we have a description from the gravity side of this, of the five-dimensional supergravity which contains this state, then you know that solving the equations of motion of this five-dimensional sector will be a solution also of the 10-dimensional equations, and this will give you a consistent solution describing deformations, flows, whatever involves these operators and only these operators.
So there will be a contribution from the mathematics.
Of course, there is. Yes, of course, of course.
As far as quantum numbers are concerned,
yes.
Acceptable.
Yeah, yeah. I've been sketchy here. Of course, all these operators really have plus dots dot dots in the sense that, of course, you have to complete this, and this completion will be dependent on the internal theory. But if you take only these operators, their OPEs will close among themselves because of the... At the supergravity level, no. I mean, that's... that's exactly...
So the true multiplet, which is dual gravitation, is the Ferrara-Sumino multiplet. It's not class-3-level. If you have... Clearly, you need the matter to make the theory superconformal, otherwise the theory will not be...
Yeah, of course.
And then once you... the multiplet, which is due to the graviton, consists also of the matter part. The R-symmetry current, for instance, cannot be simply, say,
The current in this context will be a graviphoton containing...
the graviphoton is in the bulk. Here. What I'm trying to say is that the boundary interpretation of the bulk state... As far as quantum numbers are concerned, I agree with you. I mean, in the end, there will be something that has an index alpha and an index alpha dot. That's the moral of the story. But the microscopic identification of the operator or the supermultiplet, which is dual to the supergravity multiplet, cannot be simply traced WW bar. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I mean, as I said, I mean, there will be plus something else, as been sketchy, but, I don't know, we can discuss this later, but...
What I'm saying is that these operators by themselves do not close under renormalization. I mean, they will mix with the composite operator made out of matter fields, and actually...
We can discuss this later. I mean, this result is also in the paper by Skenderis and Tsimpis. I mean, he explicitly, at least he claims to compute these OPEs, and he shows that they close among themselves, so... I mean, we can discuss it later. What do you mean? This is the superfield. This is the vector superfield. So this will have, of course, some. This is in the adjoint, and of course, you cannot take the trace. And indeed, this is a pure gauge from the supergravity point of view. In the T11, you have W alpha, and then you have A and B. W alpha is in the adjoint of SUN. You'll have two actually of them.
Why is it not nilpotent? Why there are only these five objects? Why you don't have W square?
You have W. This is W alpha. Then you have W square.
Why you don't have W cube? W to the fourth.
You don't have W cube because you cannot construct. Of course. If it was a U1, it's obvious to see that.
U1,
if it's not a U1, you can use the identity that we actually use in the paper of the T11. That was precisely the point. You can see that you cannot have operators which exceed the quartic power. They do not appear also in the spectrum, if you remember, in the T11. We have operators and we have multiplets with this. Then, of course, we have full Kaluza-Klein towers because we also have this operator. On top of this, you can add AB to the K, for instance, which is what I said before. You can add an infinite number of matter fields, but you don't have anything which has more than this power in W. So, anyway, if you want to try to describe the dual of these, where, as I said, I mean, of course, here, I'm, this is a sketchy representation of all the operators which are essentially singlets with respect to the flavor indices, that's the point, then you can use the structure that I mentioned before, the fact that these are Sasaki-Einstein manifolds, and hence they are described via these forms and the algebraic conditions and the differential conditions which describe these manifolds. And as you can see, I mean, you have a five-dimensional manifold which is described in terms of these objects, and these objects are not simply harmonic forms on the manifold, they're not closed. By doing so, you can propose an ansatz for the metric, which of the 10-dimensional metric, which of course includes an arbitrary five-dimensional space-time, a four-dimensional Kähler-Einstein base, and the eta, which describes essentially the U1 vibration. And of course, we try to deform these ansatz, but not much. We want to preserve the Sasakian structure. Preserving the Sasakian structure means essentially that we'll expand all the fields in terms of these forms. And indeed, for instance, if you take the tensor field, the two form of type 2b, this will have an expansion in terms of a two form, a one form vector expanded, which is the part which goes along eta, a two scalar field expanded along J, in the direction along J, and a complex scalar, which is the expansion along omega. Now, the interesting thing is that the five-dimensional gauge symmetry is, of course, inherited from the form gauge, from the Kalb-Ramon gauge transformation and diffeomorphism, give a structure which is not a standard gauge algebra, but they have the structure of a free differential algebra, which again is related to Ricardo's work, of course, especially in the context of flux compactification. This is essentially a flux compactification, even though it's not done to four dimensions, it's done to five dimensions. And the same thing that we have found in four dimensions, I mean, going from 10 to 4 in 2005, where we found that there was a free differential algebra structure rather than a standard gauge algebra when you have fluxes involved, appears also here. And indeed, you see that the two form is charged under the gauge transformations of the one form. So the resulting supergravity indeed is an interesting five-dimensional n equals 4 gauge supergravity whose content is given by a graviton and two vector multiplets, a graviton multiplet and two vector multiplets. The scalar manifold is a coset manifold like this. And it has a rather interesting and, again, peculiar gauge group. This five-dimensional gauge theory has a gauge group, gauge supergravity has a gauge group which is the product of a Heisenberg group and the U1R. You may be puzzled by the fact that I have an n equals 4 gauge supergravity, because you know that generically the supergravity, the dual supergravity theory, will have twice as many supersymmetries as the boundary field theory. So you have n equals 1 on the one side, and here I'm saying that the spectrum and the theory is n equals 4, not n equals 2. So why is that? Well, that's actually an interesting thing that we discovered trying to do this. And the important thing is that essentially, I mean, from the duality point of view, the important thing is the fact that we keep this operator, this operator which has 1W alpha and 2W bar, which corresponds to a massive gravitino multiplet. So this means that in the spectrum there should be also a massive gravitino. So it's not just twice as many supersymmetries, but you also have some additional gravitinos, which, however, should always be massive. And indeed, that's the interesting part of the supergravity. In the reduction, the supergravity gives you compactifying on this Sasaki-Einstein manifold, you get an n equals 4 supergravity model with, indeed, 4 gravitinos, because you get 2 essentially per 10-dimensional type 2b gravitino, pseudo-Majorana and so on, a symplectic Majorana, probably, should have said, not pseudo, sorry. But there is some sort of Stuckelberg coupling for the gravitino. So there are 2 of these gravitinos which have a Stuckelberg coupling with a fermion. So essentially, you will never have vacua which have n equals 4. You have an n equals 4 theory at the level of the Lagrangian, but you have a Stueckelberg coupling, and hence any vacuum will have at most half of the supersymmetry. And then the other interesting thing is that there are many, I mean, of the vectors that I've shown you before, you have 6 vectors in the gravity multiplet plus other 2 vectors. Many of these are charged, well, 4 of these are charged in a non-trivial, they are in a non-trivial representation, and they become tensor fields, which in 5 dimensions satisfy a first order equation of motion. So you have a rather interesting structure, really, of this supergravity. So another comment I can make about the supergravity is, of course, the gauge group, which is rather interesting. We know that the local symmetries on the gravity side correspond to global symmetries on the field theory side. Now, the U1R is clear. The U1R is the R symmetry which you have in these superconformal field theories. The Heisenberg 3, however, begs for an explanation. The origin of this group is clear. The explanation on the dual field theory side is not. The origin comes from the fluxes. As I said, this is a flux compactification. So you turn on a five-form flux, you deform the five-dimensional theory. You turn on geometric fluxes, which means the metric is deformed, which comes from the fact that this eta and omega are not closed. They satisfy relations that I showed you before. This gives you an additional gauging. And this is the final gauge group. As I said, the U1R isometry is clear. The Heisenberg 3 maybe doesn't have. I mean, it's just an accidental symmetry. I don't know. But it should be interesting to try to understand it from the dual field theory point of view. Then the other interesting thing is that, as I said, you have vectors which are charged, and hence you need to introduce some tensor fields. You have 4 vectors which are the gauge vectors of this Heisenberg 3 times U1R, and indeed if you write the gauge generators in this basis, you'll have the adjoint structure constants here, but you have 4 vectors also which are in a non-trivial representation of the gauge group. And actually, in 5 dimension, the fact that, I mean, this kind of structure, the fact that you can have vectors in non-trivial representations, of course, was discovered by many different authors in different contexts. But in the context of five-dimensional supergravity, especially the fact that there may be some special vectors which transforms and mix with the ones in the adjoint, because you can see here, there are vectors which are in the adjoint and mix among themselves. There are vectors which are in a non-trivial representation and rotate essentially. And actually, they rotate under the charge symmetry of the gauge supergravity. But there are also vectors which are which mix with the vectors in the adjoint. And this was foreseen first in 5 dimensions by Tuan in a paper where he discussed n equals 2, where he extended actually the paper we had with Anna on n equals 2. But I think this is, at least to my knowledge, the first time that we find this from compactifications of string theory of this mechanism. I don't know, I mean, if any of you has an example, I would be happy, but I didn't find any example in which you have this mixing between vectors in the adjoint and vectors in non-trivial representations coming from string theory. And of course, these vectors must be dualized to tensors somehow, and indeed, in the effective theory, you'll have couplings like this. So as I said, the supergravity theory is very interesting by itself, but of course, it's also very important because it has interesting applications in the context of the EDS-CFT correspondence. Then we have a gauge supergravity. And essentially, this is almost the last comment I want to make. But the fact that you have a gauge supergravity gives a gauge potential, a scalar potential. The scalars you have in the theory, and we have 11 scalars, will be charged with respect to the various isometries. You see here, I kept K, which is the five-form flux, explicitly. I didn't keep you can deform, instead of taking d eta equal j, you can put a number there too to parameterize the geometric fluxes. We didn't do that. But still, you have a non-trivial scalar potential, which has 2 vacua. You have 1 vacuum, which is supersymmetric, but as I said, it preserves half of the supersymmetry. It doesn't preserve n equals 4, it preserves n equals 2, and the gauge group is broken to U1, which essentially corresponds to the compactification on this Sasaki-Einstein manifold, keeping the metric round. And for instance, if you would consider this truncation in the case of the sphere, it would be simply the 5 sphere. However, there is another n equals 0 vacuum, where supersymmetry is broken and the gauge group is completely broken. All the vector fields become massive. And the metric is squashed. So you still have this five-dimensional manifold being the product of a four-dimensional Kähler space and a U1 vibration. But for instance, in the sphere also you could do that. But the U1 vibration essentially now is squashed with respect to the base. So this is another n equals zero vacuum, which means that all these conformal field theories will have, in principle, now I have to make a caveat here, but in principle, there may be flows, of course, connecting these two vacua. So there may be that there may be deformations for all these conformal field theories, which lead to a conformal field theory, again, non-supersymmetric, for which we can discuss something. We can discuss, for instance, the spectrum, of course, of the masses from the dual supergravity point of view, and check what are the anomalous dimensions of the operators which are generated. And of course, if you can do this for, since this is a universal sector, this will be true for any, for each one of the various manifolds that I've described before, the T11, the YPQ spaces, the LPQRs, and hence for all the dual conformal field theories. The subtlety is the following, that here I kept only a certain sector, of course. So as I said, I did a consistent truncation. However, this doesn't mean that I kept the lightest modes. Here, as you can see, all the modes have a positive mass, so the vacuum is stable in this sector, but there may be other scalar fields which have negative mass, and hence this n equals zero vacuum may be unstable. So some of these, well, this means that you will have a complex conformal dimension, so the field theory wouldn't make sense in that case. Negative, I mean below the Breiten-Lohner-Friedmann bound, sorry. Not just negative, but below the Breiten-Lohner-Friedmann bound. This, however, means that this is true, for instance, for the five sphere. For the five sphere, we know that there is a mode which is below the Breiten-Lohner-Friedmann bound. So, yes, the squash metric has a mode which is below the Breiten-Lohner-Friedmann bound. I mean, I have the explicit computation also, so I can show you that too, if you want. However, nothing is known for the other manifolds, for the T11, for the YPQ, and so on. For the T11, we actually have the spectrum at the round vacuum, and it will be interesting to try to do the same thing at the squash vacuum to see whether all the states are indeed above the Breiten-Lohner-Friedmann bound, because in that case we will have a stable n equals zero vacuum which corresponds to a stable to a dual conformal field theory with n equals zero supersymmetry. So, of course, we have this theory, and you can try to discuss possible applications. There are as many here. I listed some. Of course, the first one that came to my mind was already done years ago by Girardello, Petrini, Porati, and Zaffaroni, which is, of course, to try to turn on, for instance, the Gugino condensate operator and see what happens. You have also non-supersymmetric deformations, including both VEVs and the Antonin onde operator, which reach the infrared fixed point. And in the case that this infrared fixed point is really stable, this will be very interesting to study. Of course, there are applications to holographic superconductors, and for instance, these people have used a subsector of what we have used in order to construct a holographic superconductor which gains conformal symmetry in the infrared. And also, it could be used in the context of trying to find non-relativistic conformal symmetry backgrounds, because you have massive vectors, so you can be used in principle to obtain both Schrödinger and Lifshitz symmetry. And indeed, in the case of Schrödinger, that's exactly what Maldacena, Martelli, and Tachikawa did, again, in a subsector of what we have done here. So summarizing, I have tried to show you that any superconformal field theory has some sort of universal spectrum of pure gauge operator, which is finite, and for which you can give a supergravity dual description, which is a consistent truncation of type 2B supergravity, compatifying on this squashed Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. As I said, there are countless applications, and possibly I will report about this next time. I just want to conclude, of course, by wishing again happy 70th birthday to Ricardo. And as we've seen, Ricardo is a man of passion. He has a passion for physics. He has a passion for Mozart. He has a passion for the pipe. But nobody mentioned the passion for another thing, which is, which is Rome. And of course, I wish that this may be the year puoi toccare ferro. And as they say now in Rome, non succede, ma se succede. Again, happy birthday, Riccardo.
Please, short questions. Because
question about is there a Betti multiplet? So is there a massless vector associated to the fact that this manifold have a non-trivial two-cycle, and then being compact, also a non-trivial two-cycle.
We actually studied also the truncations with the Betti, but of course the Betti will depend now on the internal manifold. Now, in the T11, the LPQR, and the YPQs, you will always have, again, one Betti vector multiplet. Not only the Betti vector, you also have a Betti hypermultiplet, which is also very interesting because it describes, for instance, in the T11, you have two gauge groups, and the running of the two gauge couplings, one with respect to the other ones, is described precisely by the Betti hypermultiplet. So this is also an interesting sector with which you can enlarge this truncation, and we actually did a computation. I mean, it's not yet in that paper. It will be in a future one, hopefully. And
thank you very much.
Okay. So before going for lunch, we will ask Gian Guido to report of a small message, little message from Silvia, who is also here present in spirit. And
Silvia sent us these slides where she says that she tried to come, but the volcano didn't let her do so. And of course, she also wishes Ricardo happy birthday.
Okay.